In association with the Possum Point Players of Georgetown, Delaware, the Ad Hoc Touring Company presents A Defining War and Daniel Webster. The Ad Hoc Touring Company is devoted to the preservation of old-time radio, bringing performances of classic radio shows to audiences throughout Delmarva. Our program today is an adaptation, partly whimsical, mostly factual, of the dramatic events that surrounded the War of 1812 on the bicentennial of that largely forgotten conflict. It begins, as ad hoc programs usually do, with the recreation of an American radio classic.
The Johnson Wax Program with Fibber McGee and Molly.
We interrupt this program for a special war bulletin from the NBC newsroom. This is Bill Evans, NBC News. It's early evening here in Washington. The date, September 12, 1814. A day in which history is about to be made in nearby Baltimore. Let's go live right now to correspondent Les Cooper at Fort McHenry.
Thanks, Bill. NBC has just learned that a large force of British regulars, about 4,500 seasoned troops, has come ashore at nearby North Point, spearheading a drive to capture the small American garrison here at Fort McHenry. If that wasn't bad enough, we've been informed that a large British fleet has sailed up the Chesapeake to attack the fort by sea. A two-pronged assault seems ready to begin. A steady rain is falling, but it hasn't dampened the spirit of the American defenders, who seem ready and eager to give the British invaders a big, bloody nose. As darkness descends on Baltimore Harbor, my eyes are drawn to a tall flagpole at the center of the fort. There, flapping gently, is the garrison's battle flag, waving defiantly to bolster the morale of the defenders and to send a warning signal to the invaders. That message is, come closer and die. Back to you, Bill.
Thanks, Les. Let's go next to NBC correspondent Lisa Lane in downtown Baltimore, where confusion and fear are the order of the day. Lisa, please, bring us up to date.
As you said, Bill, there's plenty of confusion here in the country's third largest metropolis. I'm talking right now to a Baltimore resident who fears for the worst.
It's terrible. The British are going to set us afire just like they did in Washington. They are animals. There's so many of them. God help us.
And that pretty much describes the scene here in downtown Baltimore. Fear approaching panic. Indeed, the British are coming, and they are bringing death and destruction with them. Back to you, Bill.
Thanks, Lisa. The Associated Press now reports the British have positioned 5 bomb catches, 10 smaller warships, and the rocket-carrying HMS Erebus in deep water within firing range of Fort McHenry. Let's return there now. Les Cooper?
Yes, Bill, I'm here, reporting from a hastily dug trench, ducking the British rocket fire, which is unrelenting. Wait a minute. The barrage seems to be ending. Yes, and the British vessels out in the river appear to be weighing anchor. Behind me, the fort's battle flag has been pulled down. It's being replaced now by a huge banner, measuring at least 40 feet in width and 30 feet high. What a beautiful sight! Gone now is the rocket's red glare and the bombs bursting in air. Plenty of proof through the night that our flag is still there. Back to you, Bill.
Sounds like you have the makings of a great poem there, Les. And you are right. The Americans have driven off both the British Navy and her army forces. Victory is in reach. Peace is at hand. It's a great day for the fledgling American nation. All of us can hold our heads high again. I'm told that our correspondent in Baltimore, Lisa Lane, has a tentative list of casualties from the land and sea battles at Fort McHenry. Lisa?
Thanks, Bill. Preliminary numbers from the War Office show 4 Americans dead and 24 wounded. British losses appear to be 330 killed, wounded, or captured. You can honestly say the Americans gave mighty Great Britain a royal drubbing. Now, back to you, Bill.
Thanks, Lisa Lane in Baltimore and our intrepid Les Cooper reporting live from Fort McHenry. Now I'd like to introduce a lady known throughout Baltimore as a humanitarian, a tireless social worker, and last but not least, a celebrated seamstress. Mary Young Pickersgill designed and created the massive flag that's flying over Fort McHenry right now. Mary, your flag is a triumph.
What? I thank you, Mr. Evans. Why, it never would have happened except for a commission I received from Major George Armistead, the commander of forces at Fort McHenry. He told me to make a flag so large that the British would have no trouble seeing it from a great distance.
Did you personally stitch it together?
I surely did, with the able assistance of my daughter Caroline, two of my nieces, and two of our servants. We managed to complete the commission in just 6 weeks. Now, to give you an idea of how large it is, each star measures 2 feet from tip to tip, and each stripe is 2 feet wide. Your reporter at Fort McHenry got the size almost exactly right. It is 42 feet long and 30 feet high, bigger than my house. And the British have no trouble at all seeing it from miles away.
What a great, inspiring story. Thank you, Mary Young Pickersgill. We now have our correspondent in Lewis, Delaware, on the line, Mary Mason. It's been over a year since the brave people of Lewis stood down the invading British. What's it like there now?
Thankfully, all is quiet now, Bill. You'll remember that the British Navy came ashore and shamelessly requested food and provisions for the fleet. The commander was willing to pay top dollar for the supplies, but he was rebuffed by the plucky Americans, led by Colonel Samuel Boyer Davis. Angered by the rejection, the British retaliated by launching a cannon and rocket attack on the town. Miraculously, no one died, and the only confirmed casualties were a killed chicken and a pig who sustained a broken leg. After 22 hours, in which they fired nearly 1,000 cannonballs and hundreds of rockets, the British withdrew.
Was that the last that Lewis heard from the Brits, Mary?
They tried a few probing attacks after that, Bill, but there were no serious confrontations. The American defenders had proven to be more than a match for the country with the most powerful military machine in the world. American honor and independence had been preserved.
Thanks, Mary. And so ends our live coverage of a pivotal battle in the War of 1812. From the NBC Newsroom in Washington, I'm Bill Evans. We now return to our next scheduled program, a radio adaptation of a historical fantasy, The Devil and Daniel Webster. Daniel Webster! Daniel Webster! Daniel Webster!
Neighbor, how stands the Union?
The nation stands as she stood, rock-bottomed in copper sheaths, one and indivisible.
So be it.
Daniel Webster was the biggest man in the country. He never got to be president, but he was the biggest man. A man with a mouth like a mastiff, a brow like a mountain, and eyes like burning anthracite. That was Daniel Webster in his prime. His life in politics began just as the War of 1812 was getting underway. He was a very vocal opponent of that war, putting himself against the president, James Madison. But no one ever questioned his patriotism. He loved America, and he loved what it stood for, liberty, independence, and basic human rights, but especially the Union. His greatest fear? That his beloved Union would be torn apart. He proved to be a prophet. In his later years as a lawyer, his most important case never made the history books. That's because he prosecuted the devil with no holds barred. This is the way they told it back then.
Jabez! Jabez!
What is it?
What are you sitting there for, Jabez?
Come near. There ain't no use for a lot of hollering.
I seen you from the kitchen window. Jabez Stone, sitting out here doing nothing, and you with all this plowing to do. What ails you, man?
I'm plumb sick of the whole business. That's what I am.
What's the matter now?
Whoa there, Daisy. Well, I just broke the plowshare on a rock that I swear wasn't there yesterday.
Well, now, Jabez, there's no use crying over...
And then, as I was fixing to look at the plowshare, the off horse began to cough. The ropey kind of cough that means sickness and horse doctors.
Well, I got my own troubles to worry about. What with two of the children down with measles and me none too strong myself.
Well, I'm sick and tired of the whole business. Everything goes wrong all the time.
Why, now you stop this, Jabez Stone. Why, you've got good land here and a good farm.
Yeah, but it don't prosper me. If I plant corn, I get borers. If I plant potatoes, I get blight.
There's no use to go taking on so, Jabez. Just because your old plow got broke on a rock. Stones crop up in other folks' fields.
And boulders crop up in mine. I'm the unluckiest man in the whole state of New Hampshire.
Now, Jabez, there's some folks bound to be just like that. Unlucky.
Well, this is the last straw. I vow it's enough to make a man want to sell his soul to the devil.
Jabez Stone!
And I would, too, for 2 cents.
Shame on you. Notice is always taken of things like that, Jabez. You'd better take that back.
I won't. For 2 cents and a change of luck, I'd sell my soul to the devil.
Then I'm scared for you, Jabez Stone, and for us all. Notice is always taken of things like that. Sooner or later, just like the good book says.
Pa, there's a man to see you outside.
Who is it, boy?
I don't know. I never see him before.
Tell him we're at supper and ask him in, son.
He said he couldn't come in. He wants to see you outside, Pa.
Oh, yes, yes. Keep my soup warm for me, Maddie. I'll be right back, I think.
What's he look like, Thomas? A stranger?
Queer-like. He smiles all the time, and his teeth are awful white. And kind of pointed, too. And sharp.
Well, how is he dressed?
All in black. Looks like a city feller. With a black hat, too, and pointed whiskers. Got a nice smart buggy, though. Shiny and brand new looking. And Ma, the funniest thing. When he drove up in the yard, the dog took one look at him and run away howling with his tail between his legs.
Never mind about the soup, Maddie. It's a lawyer feller. Come to see me about a legacy. I and him are going to talk over some business outside.
Well, better take a lantern with you. Ain't it dark out there?
I ain't afraid.
Oh, don't be stubborn, man. Take a lantern.
All right, stranger. Where do we go?
Oh, we'll just walk down around the barn and make our little bargain, shall we, Jabez Stone?
Anywhere you say. I ain't afraid.
That's a nice farm you got here, Jabez.
It ain't now.
Oh, but it will be. After our little deal. Is that what you mean?
That's up to you. Things couldn't be worse than the way they've been.
And so you're willing to do anything to change your luck. Is that it?
Yes.
Even to selling your soul?
I said it, didn't I?
Oh, yes, I heard you this morning. Your good wife was right. Notice is always taken sooner or later, just like the good book says.
I knew you was coming.
Okay, well then, here I am. Now for the papers. Just sign your name here, Jabez Stone. Nice and plain-like.
What are the terms?
Oh, yes, the terms. Well, for 7 years you will prosper and grow rich. And at the end of which time, I come to collect.
Collect what?
Why, your soul, Jabez Stone. Your immortal soul.
Give me the pen.
Oh, not so fast. You must prick your finger to sign. Give me your hand, Jabez.
No, I'll just hold it up.
Any way you say, Jabez. Then I prick your finger with this little silver pin. So, did it hurt?
No.
Oh, don't worry about that wound, Jabez. It'll heal quick and clean, but you'll have a nice little white scar, just to remind you.
I won't need to be reminded.
You might, Jabez, you might. And now, are you ready to sign? You can write, I take it.
Give me the paper.
Oh, that's right. Oh, mighty pretty hand, too.
And now, if you'll excuse me, I'll be going. Oh,
and I'll be going, too, Jabez. Our deal and bargain is made. But I'll be back after the 7th year. Meantime, you'll be having very good luck. Oh, I'll see to that.
After that, all of a sudden, things began to pick up and prosper for Jabez Stone. His cows got fat and his horses sleek. His crops were the envy of the neighborhood, and lightning might strike all over the neighborhood, but it wouldn't strike his barn. Pretty soon, he was one of the prosperous people of the country. They asked him to stand for selectman, and he stood for it. There began to be talk of running him for state senate. All in all, you might say the Stone family was as happy and contented as cats in a dairy. And so they were, except for Jabez Stone.
Whoa there, Daisy. Not so fast, Dandelion. Now, get up. Whoa, Daisy.
Hello there, neighbor.
Oh, Daisy.
What?
Oh, Dandelion.
I say hello, neighbor.
Don't call me neighbor.
What are you staring at? Oh, it's my boots that seem to fascinate you. The very best that money can buy.
I don't like them.
Why not? Too shiny for your taste?
I don't like the looks of the toes. There are netting.
Oh, why, that shouldn't bother you, Jabez. No more than that little white scar on your finger there. It hasn't worried you, has it, Mr. Stone?
Oh, I've been contented enough. The first few years, anyway.
I dare say.
It's a great thing when bad luck turns. It drives most other things out of your head.
But there's always that little white scar to remind you.
Say, listen here, mister. Aren't you a year early?
Oh, I am. There is one more year to go before the 7 are up. But I just, dropped by for a friendly call, so to speak, to see how things are going.
Well, there's still a year to go before you collect. Then would you mind just...
Mr. Stone, you're a hummer. It's very pretty property you've got here, Mr. Stone.
Well, some might favor it, and others might not.
Oh, no need to belittle your industry. After all, we know what's been done, and it's all been according to contract and specifications. So when the mortgage falls due next year, you shouldn't have any regrets.
Speaking of that mortgage, mister, I'm beginning to have one or two doubts about it.
Doubts?
Why, yes. This being the USA, and me always having been a religious man, yes, sir, I'm beginning to have considerable doubts as to that mortgage holding up in court.
Well, if you're in doubt, let's have a look at the original document. Let's see here. Sherwin, Slater, Stevens, the Stone, here it is. I, Jabez Stone, for a term of 7 years. Oh, it's quite in order, I think.
Neighbor Stone.
What's that? That little white, a moth, it's saying Sounds like Miser Stevens.
Neighbor Stone, Neighbor Stone, help me. For God's sake, help me.
It came out of your pocketbook. What's that in your handkerchief?
Oh, that little moth. Never mind. There, it's caught again. There, now I'll just tie up the ends of this bandana so, and you won't be troubled anymore.
What was it? Oh, I think...
Oh, sorry for the interruption. Now, as I was saying...
Hold on. That was Miser Stevens' voice. And you've got him in your handkerchief.
Oh, well, now that you know it, it was very careless of me. But, well, you know, these little contretemps will occur.
I don't know what you mean by countertan, but that was Miser Stevens' voice. And he ain't dead. You can't tell me he is. He was just as spry and mean as a woodchuck Tuesday.
In the midst of life, as they say. Oh, listen, you hear? There it is now. Tolling for Miser Stevens, as you call him. And he is dead. Well, so it goes, these long-standing accounts. One really hates to close them. But business is business.
Are they all as small as that? As that little white moth I saw?
Small? Oh, I see what you mean. Why, they do vary. Don't worry, Mr. Stone. You'll go with a very good grade. Now, a man like Daniel Webster, of course, well, we'd have to build a special box for him. And even at that, I imagine the wingspread would astonish you. But in your case, as I was saying...
Put that handkerchief away.
Oh, all right. If it annoys you, I'll put it away for a year. 1 year from the day, Jabez Stone, and then...
But till you've made a bargain like that, you've no idea how fast a year can run. It seemed like it was only a week before the time was up. Till finally, Jabez Stone can't stand it any longer. And in the last evening of the year, he hitches up his horse and drives off to see Dan'l Webster. For Dan'l was born in New Hampshire, and it's well known that he has a particular soft spot for old neighbors.
That's the story then, Mr. Webster. And ashamed I am to tell it, but it had to be told to someone. And who else should it be but you?
Well, I haven't pleaded a mortgage case in a long time. And I don't generally plead now, except before the Supreme Court. But if I can, I'll help you.
Then I've got hope for the first time in 7 years. Oh, it's been awful, awful. The name of Jabez Stone has become known all over the state. I've been that prosperous. There's talk of me running for governor, and it's dust and ashes in my mouth.
Well, you certainly have given yourself the devil's own road to hoe, Neighbor Stone. But I'll take your case.
You'll take it?
Oh, yes, I've been working up some speeches to make against John C. Calhoun, and I've got 75 other things to do and the Missouri Compromise to straighten out, but I'll take your case. For if two New Hampshiremen aren't a match for the devil, we may as well give the country back to the Indians. When's he coming?
Tonight at midnight.
Where?
At my house.
Well, then we have no time to waste. You came here in a hurry yourself, didn't you?
Well, I admit I made talk.
Well, you go back faster. Wilbur! Hitch up Constitution Constellation to the carriage. They're a pair of matched grays, Mr. Stone, and they step like greased lightning.
You're going to kill these horses, Mr. Webster.
No, I won't, not these two. I like doing things full tilt, and so do they. Puts iron in your veins.
There goes my hat.
What do you care? It isn't your soul, Jabez. We've still got that.
I'm still out of breath from that ride, Mr. Webster.
Oh, you'll recover, Neighbor Stone. Take a drink, man. while we're waiting for our friend to appear. There's no better company than a jug.
He'll be here soon.
Your clock says only 11:30.
Oh, Mr. Webster, listen. For God's sake, Mr. Webster, harness your horses and get away from this place as fast as you can.
Oh, you brought me a long way, neighbor, to tell me you don't like my company.
Miserable wretch that I am. I brought you a devilish way, and now I see my folly. Let him take me if he wills, but you're the Union's strength and New Hampshire's pride. He mustn't get you, Mr. Webster. He mustn't get you.
Well, I'm obliged to you, Neighbor Stone, but there's a jug on the table and a case in hand, and I never left a jug or a case half finished in my life. Aha! I thought your clock was a trifle slow, Neighbor Stone. Come in! Now, Jabez.
Mr. Webster, I presume.
Attorney of record for Jabez Stone. Might I ask your name?
Oh, I've gone by a good many. Perhaps Scratch will do for the evening. Mr. Scratch. I've often been called that in these regions. You know the object of my errand?
I do.
Well, then, I shall call upon you as a law-abiding citizen to assist me in taking possession of my property.
Well, that's the nature of my errand here, too, this evening, Scratch. You shall not have this man.
What? Then what of the contract?
I've seen no contract.
Then here it is. Here is the deed, and see, here is the signature.
It can't be right.
But it is.
What will you take for that deed, just as it stands?
I'll take what I came for. The soul of Jabez Stone.
Ah, but wait a minute, man. The deed was made out some time ago, when the property was worth so much less. It can't hold now.
But it does.
But wait. Jabez Stone is no longer a poor farmer. The property is increased in value, and Jabez, why, state senators ought to be worth more.
What have I have to do with oughts and should-bes? I'm surprised at you, Daniel Webster. Stick to the letter of the law.
Do not put me off. I tell you, you shall not have this man's soul. Oh, do you hear me?
These spirited efforts on behalf of your client do you credit, Mr. Webster. But if you have no more argument to adduce, I'm rather pressed for time, and I've...
Pressed for now? You shall not have this man. Mr. Stone is an American citizen, and no American citizen may be forced into the service of a foreign prince. We fought England for that in 1812, and we'll fight all hell for it again.
Foreign? And who calls me a foreigner?
Well, I never yet heard of the devil claiming American citizenship.
No. And who with better right? When the first wrong was done to the first Indian, I was there. When the first slave ship put out for the Congo, I stood on her deck. Am I not in your books and stories and beliefs from the first settlements on? Am I not spoken of still in every church in New England? 'Tis true the North claims me for a Southerner and the South for a Northerner, but I am neither. Why, I am merely an honest American like yourself, and of the best descent. For to tell the truth, Mr. Webster, though I don't like to boast of it, my name is older in this country than yours.
Aha! Then I stand on the Constitution. I demand a trial for my client.
The case is hardly one for an ordinary court, and indeed the lateness of the hour.
Let it be any court you choose, as long as it is an American judge and an American jury. Let it be the quick or the dead, I'll abide the issue.
Very well, you shall have it. There, I need but clap my hands, and you have your judge and jury.
In God's name, who comes by so late? Who are these men?
The jury, Mr. Webster demands. You must pardon the rough appearance of one or two. They've come a long way.
By heaven.
You know them?
It's plain who they are. Men who have long since sold themselves to the devil. There's Walter Butler, the loyalist, who spread fire and horror through the Mohawk Valley. And there's Simon Girty, the renegade, who saw white men burned at the stake.
Look, his eyes are green, and there are stains of blood on his shirt.
Here's King Philip with a great gash in his head that gave him his death wound. And cruel Governor Dale, who broke men on the wheel. Oh, there's Morton of Merrymount, who so vexed the Plymouth colony with his hate of the god. And Teach, the bloody pirate, with his black beard curling on his breast. And see, here comes Reverend John Smeet with his strangler's hands, walking as daintily as he did to the gallows.
Look, the red paint of the rope is still around his neck.
Yes, scratches told the truth. They have all played a part in America.
Are you satisfied with the jury, Mr. Webster?
Quite satisfied, though I miss General Arnold from the company.
Well, Benedict Arnold is engaged upon other business. Oh, and you ask for a justice, I believe. Here he is. Justice Hawthorne is a jurist of experience. He presided at certain witch trials once held in Salem. There were others who repented of the business later, but not he.
Repent of such noble wonders and undertakings? Nay, hang them. Hang them all.
Oh, Mr. Webster, that can't be the judge.
Silence, silence. The court is in order. Proceed with the case. Let the defendant take the stand.
Oh, I can't. I can't. Look at that man.
Order.
There.
Order. There. What is the matter with the witness?
He's afraid of the jury, Your Honor.
Then he'll have small chance if he's afraid of the jury at the start.
May I speak for him, sir?
Say on. We have other business yet to do this night.
Well, the case is this, then, Your Honor. My poor neighbor here.
I object.
Objection sustained.
This man, Jabez Stone, then, who appears to be my good neighbor.
I object.
Objection sustained.
This man is supposed to have sold his soul to the devil.
I object.
Objection sustained.
Sold his soul for a period of 7 years' good luck. Now those 7 years are up, and this gentleman here in black has come to collect. My client is unwilling, naturally, to give up his soul, for giving up his soul seems to him, as it does to me, an act completely outside the jurisdiction of this court, and thoroughly despicable besides.
I object.
Objection sustained.
That, then, is the case before the court. The defense rests.
Very well.
For a moment.
What is your argument, Scratch?
Simply this. I overheard this man, Jabez Stone, standing in the fields, cursing his fate.
I object.
Objection denied.
Cursing his fate because he had broken his plowshare on a rock. I heard him burst into tears and say, I vow for 2 cents.
I object.
Objection denied.
So naturally, I, being in the business, so to speak, called at his house that night, and the bargain was made. It was sealed. And it was signed, and if Jabez Stone denies that his signature is affixed to this paper, then let him show the jury the little white scar on his finger, if he dares.
I object.
Objection denied. Proceed, Scratch.
Following the night of our bargain, Jabez Stone began to prosper, all as I had promised. Now the term of our contract is finished. The 7th year is ended tonight, and I have come to collect all according to contract.
Collect what? Say it in words.
His soul.
I object!
Objection denied. Everything seems quite in order as far as I can see. Have you anything further to say, Mr. Webster, before we turn the case over to the jury?
I would like to say a few words, Your Honor. Not for the sake of neighbor Stone, nor for my own sake. No, nor in argument or reply to Scratch here, but merely because the night seems good to me. Gentlemen, can you remember, recently for some of you, far, far back for others, can you remember the freshness of a fine morning when you were young, and the taste of food when you were hungry, and the new day that's every day when you're a child? I'd like to feel these things again. And so, too, I think, would you. They're good things for any man. But without freedom, they sicken. Slavery, the loss of your soul, how the very thought revolts the heart. Gentlemen, I don't care what you or anyone else might wish to do with neighbor Stone's life. But whatever you do, you cannot harm, you cannot touch his soul. Even death cannot do what Mr. Scratch here presumes to do tonight. Say what you will, the soul shall be triumphant. Imperious Caesar, dead and turned to clay, might stop a hole to keep the wind away. But his soul, gentlemen, his soul ranges the world as long as the world shall last, or time itself, or your immortal souls. The defense rests.
The jury will retire to consider the verdict.
Your Honor, I don't think we need to retire. The jury, I'm sure, has considered its verdict, and we find for the defendant, Jabez Stone.
Perhaps it's not strictly in accordance with the evidence, but even the damned may salute the eloquence of Mr. Webster.
Just as they should, at cockcrow. And now we are all alone again, we three.
So we are, Scratch. So we are.
Well, my congratulations, as between two gentlemen.
I'll have that paper first, if you please. And now, I'll have you.
Oh, come, Mr. Webster. This, ouch, let go. This is ridiculous.
Now you'll sit right down at that table and draw up a document promising never to bother Jabez Stone, nor his heirs, or assigns, nor any other New Hampshire man till doomsday. For any hell we want to raise in this state, we can raise ourselves without assistance from strangers.
Oh, okay, ouch. Okay, I agree.
Feeling better now, neighbor Stone?
I can't even speak.
How about it, Scratch?
Here it is, Mr. Webster. Proper and legal. And now may I go?
Go? Say, what can you do for me before I kick you out?
Well, I'm not a talented man like yourself, Mr. Webster, but I could tell your fortune for you.
Well, I don't take much stock in fortune-telling ordinarily, but... Well, it pleases me to listen. Here's my hand. No tricks now.
An interesting palm, Mr. Webster. The future's not as bright as you think. It's dark. You have great ambitions, Mr. Webster.
I have.
It almost seems within your grasp, but you will not attain it. Lesser men will be passed over.
And if I am, I'll still be Daniel Webster. Say on.
I see you have two strong sons. You look to found a line, but each will die in war, and neither reach greatness.
Live or die, they're still my sons. Say on.
You have made great speeches. You will make more.
Ah.
But the last great speech you make will turn many of your own against you. Even in New England, some will say you have turned your coat, sold your country, and their voices will be loud against you till you die.
One question. I've fought for the Union all my life. Will I see that fight won against those who would tear it apart?
Not while you live, but it will be won. And after you are dead, there are thousands who will fight for your cause because of words that you spoke.
Well, then, you long-barreled, slab-sided, lantern-jawed, fortune-telling note-shaver, be off to your own place before I put my mark on you. For by the 13 original colonies, I'd go to the pit itself to save the Union.
Ouch.
And now we'll see what's left in the jug. Spry work, talking all night. Hope there's a pie for breakfast, Neighbor Stone.
And they say that whenever the devil comes near the town of Hartsfield, even now, he gives it a wide berth. And he hasn't been seen in the state of New Hampshire from that day to this. Other states may be, but not New Hampshire.
What we just heard is fantasy, pure and simple. The real Daniel Webster was one of the most illustrious political figures of the 19th century. Among his multitude of friends was the wife of our fourth president, James Madison. Dolly Madison was one of our greatest first ladies. She was elegant, charming, warm-hearted, and politically astute. You could safely call her the Jackie Kennedy of her time. During the early days of the War of 1812, Dolly found herself alone and vulnerable in the nation's capital. She prayed fervently for the return of her husband, the president, who had been summoned out of town.
I would describe to you the fears and alarms that circulate around me. For the last week, all the city and Georgetown, except the cabinet, have expected a visit from the enemy and were not lacking in their expressions of terror and reproach. We are making considerable efforts for defense. The fort is being repaired, and 500 militia, with perhaps as many regulars, are to be stationed on the green near the windmill. The 20 tenths already look well in my eyes, who have always been an advocate for fighting when assailed, though I am a Quaker. I therefore keep the old Tunisian saber within reach. One of our generals has discovered a plan of the British. It is to land as many chosen rogues as they can about 14 miles below Alexandria in the night, so that they may be on hand to burn the president's house and offices.
And that, precisely, is what the British had in mind, to lay siege and destroy these upstart colonials who dared to challenge the military power of the world's mightiest fighting force. Dolly kept a careful watch as the Redcoats advanced through downtown Washington to the president's house itself.
Since sunrise, I have been turning my spyglass in every direction and watching with unwearied anxiety, hoping to discover the approach of my dear husband and his friends. but alas, I can make out only groups of military wandering in all directions as if there was a lack of arms or of spirit to fight for their own fireside. We have had a battle or skirmish near Bladensburg, and here I am still within sound of the cannon. Mr. Madison comes not. May God protect us. Two messengers covered with dust come to bid me fly, but here I mean to wait for him. At this late hour a wagon has been procured, and I have had it filled with plate and the most valuable portable articles belonging to the house, our house. At this late hour a wagon has been procured, and I have had it filled with plate and the most valuable portable articles belonging to the house, our nation's house. Whether it will reach its destination, the Bank of Maryland, or fall into the hands of British soldiery, events must determine. Our kind friend, Mr. Carroll, has come to hasten my departure, and in a very bad humor with me, because I insist on waiting until the large picture of General Washington is secured, and it requires to be unscrewed from the wall. This process was found too tedious for these perilous moments. I have ordered the frame to be broken and the canvas taken out. It is done, and the precious portrait placed in the hands of two gentlemen of New York for safekeeping.
Dolly managed to slip through the British lines with the priceless article she had secured from the White House. After initial reverses, the Americans turned the tables and defeated the Redcoats in several major land and naval battles. The war finally won. The Madisons retired to their Virginia plantation. No one was closer to the family than a remarkable slave named Paul Jennings. Jennings left behind a wonderful journal of his years with the Madisons.
I was always with Mr. Madison before he died, and shaved him every other day for 16 years. For 6 months before his death, he was unable to walk and spent most of his time reclined on a couch. But his mind was bright, and with his numerous visitors, he talked with as much animation and strength of voice as I've ever heard him in his best days. I was present when he died. That morning, Suki brought him his breakfast as usual. He was unable to swallow. His niece, Miss Willis, said, "Uncle James, what's the matter?" "Nothing more than a change of mind, my dear." His head instantly dropped, and he ceased breathing as quietly as the snuff of a candle as it goes out. He was 84 years old and was followed to the grave by an immense procession of white and colored people.
Paul Jennings remained with the family for many years. The president's widow was close to impoverished. Toward the end of her long life, Dolly sold the faithful Jennings to our friend, Daniel Webster, giving him the necessary funds to buy his freedom. Paul Jennings never lost his affection for James and Dolly Madison.
Miss Madison was a remarkably fine woman. She was beloved by everybody in Washington, white and colored. In the last days of her life, before Congress purchased her husband's papers, she was in a state of absolute poverty, and I sometimes think suffered for the necessaries of life. While I was a servant of Mr. Webster, he would often send me to her with a market basket full of provisions, and told me that whenever I saw anything in the house that she was in need of, to take it to her. I often did this and occasionally gave small sums from my own pocket, though I had years before bought my freedom of her.
It should be noted that Paul Jennings wrote the first account of the Madison presidency, a colored man's reminiscences of President Madison. A fascinating journal that continues to be cited by historians to this day. As for Dolly, Congress belatedly provided her with funds that lifted her from dire poverty. At the time of her death, she was honored as the first of the first ladies, a woman of enormous charm and courage whose greatest moment came in the darkest days of a war which nearly destroyed the Union only 30 years after its creation.
And that concludes A Defining War and Daniel Webster, performed by the Ad Hoc Touring Company, a proud affiliate of the Possum Point Players of Georgetown, Delaware. Roger Ault played Jabez Stone, Joe Plummer was Daniel Webster, and Charlie Meyer was the Devil. Our play also featured
Don Norton, Rehoboth Beach,
Ron Pakula, Lewis,
John Murray, Harbison,
Valerie Valentine, Milford,
Ruth Mankin, Lewis,
E.J. Panico, Seaford,
Peter Schott, Rehoboth,
Nita Gary, Lewis,
Claudius Bowden, Georgetown.
And I'm Dick Rossay. We dedicate today's show to our beloved director, George Spillane. Hurry back, George. We need you, and we miss you.
This program is a production of Delmarva Public Radio. For more information, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net. Funding is provided in part by the Maryland State Arts Council, the Salisbury-Waucomico Arts Council, and by listeners like you.